I came to this country about 3.5 years back, and I received invitations to visit this center more than once earlier, but this is the first time I could finally make it to visit this place. Now, the topic before us, as was announced earlier, is Bhagavad Gita in everyday life. Now, you know, there are many unique, special features about Bhagavad Gita as a scripture. It is part of a very big Sanskrit classic, which in its largest version runs into 145,000 verses. It will be something like 13 times the size of Homer's Iliad, Odyssey and Virgil's Annie put together. That's the larger version. In a shorter version, it's about 100,000 verses. That the size of Mahabharata, of which Bhagavad Gita is a very tiny fraction. Hundreds of dynasties, hundreds of philosophical dialogues between saints and sages and kings and philosophers of those times. Some of them among the most profound philosophical expositions. And remember, the age 3326 BC is one of the commonly accepted dates of Mahabharata. That's the size of the book. Bhagavad Gita, as I said earlier, is a very tiny fraction of the huge classical work. It is divided into 18 chapters. And in a way, it opens with a profound question, which is a question that we all ask in our everyday life. If we do not ask, either we are all great saints and sages, or we are all brutes, if we don't ask this question. What we should do, how we should go about our duties and responsibilities, our conflicts, problems of anxiety, depression, agonies, worries, and so on. You know, to understand the nature of this dialogue, I would open with an interesting conversation between two great saints. It appears in one of the Upapuranas, one of the later mythological works, which throws a light into the nature of this work. As I said, it's a form of a dialogue between a prince and his teacher. Both are in a way princes. Lord Krishna was a king and a kingmaker, and Arjuna was a prince. Arjuna was one of the five sons of his mother Kunti. She had five sons, Yudhishthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Nakula and Sahadeva. I won't go in details of the family background. Yudhishthira was a very great saint in a way, but a little foolish also. He knew all about the highest philosophy, he knew all about the highest spiritual doctrines, but he was a little bit of Hamlet of Shakespeare. He didn't know what to do, and didn't know how to do what he thought he should do. So he was some kind of a wavering Hamlet. He knew all the doctrines that are preached in the Gita, but even if he knew everything, he either didn't have the willingness or the strength of mind or strength of character to put that into practice. So Lord Krishna thought, this is the right man to whom I should teach the Gita. The next in seniority, mind you, in Indian tradition, seniority, the tyranny of seniority is a very important thing, Indian family tradition. So the senior most of the five brothers was Yudhishthira. He was a very virtuous person, very good man, who was an embodiment of many good qualities that we should all have, but somewhat indecisive, incapable of making proper use of his wisdom at all times. The next in seniority was Bhima. He was more of a wrestler, man of action, rather than man of wisdom. He was proud of his brawn rather than his brain, so to speak. So Lord Krishna thought, maybe this is not the right type of person to whom I should teach Gita. He may swing into action, without perhaps even he has fully listened to the doctrines of Gita. So Lord Krishna didn't choose him as his disciple. The third one is Arjuna. Arjuna was a brilliant man, but he had many conflicts and problems. He was a man of action, but also a man of intelligence. But he didn't know all the doctrines, all the philosophical principles of spiritual life. If he had known, he would have acted upon them. He had many doubts and conflicts and problems which all intelligent, cultured, evolved human beings have or should have. There was a crisis in front of him. Dushtvainam sujanam krishna yuchum samavasthidam sidanti mama gatrani mugham cha parishushyati vebudushya sarire me romahasya jayade gandivam samsadeh hastak tucheiva paridakhyade. This is the opening part of Arjuna's conversation, dialogue with Lord Krishna, 28th verse of the first chapter. He tells Lord Krishna, look here, Lord, in front of me, there are many people with whom I am supposed to fight. The Kauravas, his cousins, brothers, his own teachers who may have taught him martial arts like Drona, his grandsire like Bhishma, and so on. They were all people whom he had seen right from his boyhood, who had taught him, who had inspired him, who had guided him, but then who were right now standing against him to fight with him. And a Kshatriya's duty was to fight, as a farmer's duty is to do farming, or a student's duty is to learn, a teacher's duty is to teach. Sometimes Mahabharata is wrongly interpreted as a book on war, which it is not. Mahabharata deals with the conversation between two princes in a battlefield, because the king was a great philosopher and kingmaker, a spiritual teacher, and the prince was employed to do justice. Suppose you deploy a small army unit to save the lives of old men, old women and children, and if some soldiers, well, I would rather not fight with these terrorists, militants. I would rather go away, sit and go to my home and pray to God, meditate. You don't admire such a soldier. A soldier whose duty is to save the weak, the poor, the unprotected from evildoers. Or you won't admire a professor who refuses to teach in a university, who is paid for that, who is employed for that, or a student who doesn't learn, which is his duty to do. Similarly, Arjuna, while facing a problem, says, well, I'm becoming physically, mentally weak, a kind of anxiety, neurosis and depression. And this man doesn't openly say that. He tries to justify his inaction. He talks the language of a Buddha, which he is not. So, what Arjuna says is this: I don't want that. I don't want to fight with these evil men. He admits they are evil men. Na kamche vijayam krishna na cha rajyam sukhani cha kinno rajena govinda kim bhogai jeevitaina va. A language of a great man of renunciation, which he was really not. So Krishna thought this is the right man to whom Gita should be preached, because he knows there are conflicts and problems in human life, and these conflicts and problems should be explored. We should find a spiritual solution to this problem. And Krishna knew that if he really could be taught to act according to certain spiritual principles, he will act. He was not just a man of theory like his elder brother Yudhishthira was. And he was not a brute like Bhima was. And he was not immature as his two younger brothers with small children, Nakula and Sahadeva, little small children. So they won't perhaps understand, even if Lord Krishna had chosen them as his disciples to learn, to teach these great spiritual truths. So Krishna knew this man realizes that there are problems in human life. And these problems should be properly understood, analyzed, and we must try to make use of our spiritual wisdom to confront these problems. Now, this is how Arjuna begins his conversation. And you know, at the end of the Gita, 18th chapter, at the end of the 18th chapter, the last chapter of Gita, the same Arjuna concludes his conversation. Nashto moha smidil labdha tu prasada maya achyuda siddhosmi vedasandeha karishi vachanam tava. So the man who didn't know how to go about doing his duties and responsibilities, who was facing a crisis of mind, a conflict and anxiety, a kind of depression, who expressed all these ideas at the beginning of the first chapter, tells his teacher at the end of the whole text, towards the end of the 18th chapter, "O Lord Krishna, I have listened to you. Now my doubts are gone. I am free from all confusion, all doubts, all depression or conflicts. I shall act according to your instruction." And Arjuna decides to do his duty. Now, in this process, you find there are four stages in Arjuna's mind, in the evolution of Arjuna's mind. This man who first complained to Lord Krishna that he was facing a great conflict, a great problem of anxiety, and then wanted a solution to these problems. At the end of the chapter, he says, "I am now free from all my doubts and conflicts." There are four levels. First stage is a stage of total inaction, which is always to be avoided. Inaction not because you want to go to forest and to meditate like Lord Buddha did when he saw the four Chattvari Aryasatyani, the four noble truths. He wanted to really understand the problem of human sorrow, human suffering. He was a prince. He left his kingdom, everything behind, and went and sat under a tree and meditated and found a great solution to a great problem of human existence, human crisis. Now, if you are a Buddha, you can do that. But very often we would like to imagine ourselves to be Buddhas and try to find a philosophical, a spiritual justification for our inaction. Instead of raising ourselves and our mind to a higher level, we often try to bring the ideal to our level and then try to delude ourselves into thinking that we are very intelligent, we are following great philosophical doctrine. So the first stage is a most despicable, and that's the lowest to be always avoided by all thinking intelligent human beings. The stage of total inaction, inertia, ignorance, delusion and conflicts, and then we withdraw from all actions. A stage of moron or idiot as in human psychology, the lower level. And Lord Krishna says this is the lowest stage of human existence, should be always avoided. The next stage, a better stage, is to act with a strong ambition, with a definite goal, with maybe with strong attachment to do something good, work for a higher goal. It's always good to try to be a rich man without deviating from the path of righteousness, by following the path of righteousness, by holding certain spiritual ethical values. If you try to achieve something big in this material world, nothing wrong in it. That is always better than doing nothing, to be steeped in a state of tamoguna, as sometimes we call it, a state of total ignorance, inaction and inertia. The third stage is to be active, to be as active as the most ambitious person in the world is active, but without ambition. Can we combine the efficiency, the dynamism of a Bill Gates or a Henry Ford, along with that detachment of a saint and sage, as we call kingly for all external appearances, sagely within? Sagely within, kingly without. If we can combine efficiency, action and dynamism with contemplation, calmness of the mind, being fully established in tranquility without any conflict, that a third stage is called Karma Yoga. The fourth stage is the stage of a philosopher. You can be fully established in a state of perfect action, action for the good of others, without any attachment, mind as calm, as quiet, as tranquil as a calm ocean, but always active. Now, sometimes we imagine if a person sits quiet, we often misinterpret him to be a great saint. See, if a dog has no teeth, you can't be sure whether it bites or not. So, a spiritual person can be tested only in the field of action. If he can, in the field of action, we should be efficient, enthusiastic. At the same time, this action should not become a disease. Because many of the most successful persons in the world do not sleep well at night. They lose sleep. The highest suicide rate is found in those countries where perfectionism is the norm. Japan, for example, Sweden, Switzerland, some of the most advanced countries where the trains and planes all run on time, where everything, social security, Medicare, everything is perfectly in order. The very few homeless people. But the largest, highest percentage suicide rate. So which means efficiency, perfectionism are not enough. Mind demands something else. This is possible. This problem can be solved only if we can combine success without any success and mental peace. Because success sometimes brings in its train a number of problems, you know, called problems of abundance, as they call. The richest man, as I said, doesn't get sleep at night, suffering from anxiety, depression, neurosis and all. In most of the advanced countries, most of countries which are scientifically and technologically advanced, you find this problem, the problems of abundance. Everything goes on fine, but something is wanting, something is lacking within. The peace of mind, the tranquility. So Lord Krishna concludes Gita with the solution to this problem. The art of combining a mind which is at peace with itself and at peace with the rest of the world, plus action and success. Success plus mental peace. How to achieve this? So these are the four stages of Arjuna's mind in his evolution. Four stages of evolution of Arjuna's mind. From the lowest level of ignorance and delusion
to a level of action with dynamism and attachment. Then third stage, action without attachment, action with perfect contemplation. And the fourth stage is stage in which you naturally act without attachment, where every action becomes an act of worship, where every thought becomes a meditation, where whole life gets spiritualized, with the line of bifurcation, dividing line between the secular and spiritual vanishes. Every action becomes spiritual, whole life gets spiritualized. These are the four stages. Now, in the Gita, there are two approaches to attain this goal. One, the approach of Gita, approach of yogas, the four yogas, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja Yoga, and Karma Yoga. These are the four yogas which constitute one definite approach to practice the highest spirituality and the noblest action in our everyday life. So that life itself becomes an easy way. In a way, it becomes a combination of spirituality, at the same time, the art of confronting problems that we face in our everyday life. The second approach is, it is mentioned in the 18th chapter, that is actually linked to one of the four yogas, but it has its own individual importance, it has its own special features. So I thought I would rather present it differently. That is called complete surrender. You find the 66th verse of the 18th chapter, Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mamekam Saranam Vraja Aham Tva Sarva Papi Bhyu Mokshayishyami Mahasucha. Actually, you know, this verse has got a special importance because it analyzes the conflict between free will and human effort, which is frequently a problem that we all face in this world. Sometimes we ask, if God is the one who decides everything, then where is our role? If everything depends upon God's grace, then what is the, then where do we stand? What's the role of human effort? All these problems are discussed, in fact, in this verse. The verse literally means you give up all your thoughts as to what is right and what is wrong. You surrender to me, dedicate to me, and then I shall look after you. Then you don't have to worry. I shall protect you. This is a promise from the Lord. Now, here, as I said earlier, you know, a synthesis of God's grace and human effort you can find here. I can start this discussion with a small quotation from a well-known Christian scripture, that is the first volume of St. Teresa of Avila's autobiographical writings. There's an interesting description of harmonizing, synthesizing human effort or free will and God's grace. A farmer is trying to irrigate the land. The land is not yet ready. The field is not ready. The field is full of thorns, pebbles, stones, and so on, weeds and all that. Now, if you irrigate a field without removing all the weeds and thorns and grass, then it's no use. Grains won't grow, only weeds will grow, grass will grow. So before you cultivate, before you sow the seed, the field should be prepared, should be made ready. You should remove all the feed, stones and so on. And then, she says, then we can bring water. Maybe according to her, in those days, in medieval times, you can use a water mill, you can bring water from a river through a canal, you can bring water maybe in buckets. It all involves human effort. But all this should be done only after removing the weeds, the stones, the thistles, and the grass. Now suppose you make the field ready, you clean up the whole field, you remove all the weeds and grass and stones, everything. At that time, and you are able to make, you are struggling to irrigate the field by bringing water. At that time, if it rains, then the field will be well irrigated. So here you find the rain corresponds to God's grace. The effort involved in removing the grass, the weeds and stones, pebbles and all this, or the effort that you made to bring water from nearby water mill, or maybe canal, a river or a well, all this correspond to human effort. But if you don't make your own effort, God's grace itself won't work. So if you don't make the field ready for irrigation, then rainfall will not help you. Suppose God appears in front of us, we may mistake him for somebody who has come to listen to this lecture. So when our mind is pure, through meditation, through spiritual practices, through listening to spiritual ideas, by reading spiritual scriptures. If your mind is ready, if your mind becomes purified, then if God appears before you, then you'll recognize God as God. Before we are ready, we won't be able to appreciate God's grace. We won't even be able to recognize God's grace as God's grace. It'll be of no use to us. Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, in his Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, uses another example. There are several examples. One, suppose you try to cross the river. There is strong wind blowing. But right now the boat is tied to the anchor. So, if you sit on the bank of the river and just express your desire to cross the river, that won't do any good to you. You have to first of all get up, you have to untie the anchor, release it from the anchor, and then you should row for some distance till you reach midstream, and then only you will be able to make proper use of the wind that is blowing. Otherwise, you can't cross the river. So there is an effort involved in getting up, releasing the boat from the anchor and rowing for some distance till you reach the midstream so that you will be able to make proper use of the wind that is blowing. So human effort makes us worthy of grace. If we do not make our mind ready, God's grace won't be of much use to us. So in this chapter, in this verse, Lord Krishna says, you give up everything, your whole will you place at my feet. Means you consider myself as the actor and you are only the instrument. But to be able to do that properly, we must reach a particular stage of spiritual purity, mental purity. Otherwise, we will do trade with God. You know, I have heard a funny story about it. A man, maybe a woman if you don't mind, once took a vow, if I get $1,000, I shall donate to the nearby church. And as it happened, he was walking in the street and he found a wallet lying there. Nobody was watching. And there's $1,000. No, sorry, only $500. So he thought, God, you have taken your share already. So this $500 is mine. He didn't think that $250 he could give to the church, because, but he thought, your share you already taken. So what happens, you know, when we surrender ourselves to God, frequently it becomes only an attempt to surrender. When it really becomes a surrender, then behind every act we do, every word we speak, every thought we think, we will always see God's hand, God's mind working behind. If we don't do that, then we are only taking a verbal vow to surrender ourselves to God's will, which is technically called prapatti in the tradition of Ramanuja's Vishishta Advaita system. Anugulyasya sankalpaha pradyugulyasya varjanam rakshasyaveti vishwasaha goptrutva varanam tatha atma nikshepa karpanne sadvidha sharanagati. So a wonderful definition of what it means to surrender ourselves to God's will. There is no, it is not a slavish surrender of our individuality to God. Rather, it is an expansion of our individuality. When the river joins the ocean, it gets expanded. It reaches a higher level of purity, sublimation, and expansion. Sometimes, you know, in many, in some traditions, surrender is often taken to be a kind of slavish surrender. No, in a way, there is an element of complete surrender, but that surrender is a kind of self-purification. So this particular verse says, if we can only think positive thought currents, anukulyasya sankalpaha, means you think only of positive thoughts, positive ideas, and avoiding negative currents. That is very important in spiritual life, in everyday life. We should develop a kind of spiritual filtering mechanism in our mind to avoid the influence, to save ourselves from the influence of people who may feed us with negative thoughts. It's a very important principle in spiritual life. We may work hard, but before we are fully established in spiritual life, we must try to develop a kind of inner filtering mechanism which helps us to avoid the influence of negative thought currents. And then rakshasyaveti vishwasaha, we have strong faith that God is a one protector. Goptrutta varanam tada, God is the only leader, the only protector. So, a kind of total self-resignation to God's will and a strong aversion towards our attachment to our own body, which stands in the way of spiritual progress. In this process of self-surrender, there is one problem, one serious challenge that we have to face in our everyday life. That's what many devotees frequently ask again and again. We try to meditate, we try to pray, we try to read scriptures, but frequently there are crises, there are problems and challenges and conflicts that take our mind away from them. Financial crisis, social, job insecurity problems, and so on. Family problems. All these sometimes become great obstacles, especially for the beginners in spiritual life. How to develop a healthy psychological approach towards the common day problems, everyday problems in spiritual life? This subject is dealt with in an ancient classical devotional work. I shall quote this verse, then I shall explain in English. The verse is, Yasya anugraham icchami tasya vittam haramiham bandhavaischa viyogena bhrasham bhavadu dukkhita atma nikshepakar then tena dukkhena samtapto yadi mam na parityajet tam prasadam karishyami yad devairabhi sudurlabham. It's an interesting verse. Please don't mind. My style is to quote these verses. Without quoting these verses, I can't give classes. This is my style. But you are always free. I rather welcome it. You can always ask me at the end of this lecture during interaction to explain any of these ideas which I have not made clear enough to you during this lecture. So I shall explain this verse. Yasya anugraham icchami tasya vittam harameham bandhavaischa viyogena bhrasham bhavati dukkhita tena dukkhena samtapto yadi mam na parityaje tam prasadam karishyami yad devairabhi sudurlabham. Now how here you find the dynamics of facing problems in spiritual life. Suppose God really wants to help you. Suppose God really wants to show His grace to you. Then what He does is, He removes you from the path of obstacles, or He removes the obstacles from your path. If God doesn't care a damn for you, then He will let you play enough. You get rich as much as you make as many billions as possible and get lost. But if God has a compassionate mind, if He really wants to show His grace to you, then He won't let you perish. What He does, He will remove you from the path of obstacles and remove the obstacles from your path. How He does it? So meaning is this, the one who becomes very rich and so proud of his wealth, that he completely forgets his spiritual goal. He becomes a demagogue. He becomes a Shylock, a demon. What God, if that person has done some good deeds in his past life, what God turns into a pauper. Not a very pleasant approach on the part of God, you know. We often pray to God, give us wealth, money, everything. God will give you. Because He doesn't want you to get the highest spiritual goods. So, like you give Him, God will give you a little wealth, alright. You may have to go through several lives to become really devoted to God. But if you are really a great spiritual seeker, then what happens? God will remove wealth from your path by turning you into a pauper. Because wealth becomes a great obstacle, which reduces you into a monster. So, that obstacle is removed from your spiritual path. And then if you are very proud of your friends, secret friends everywhere, and you think that they are my people, you completely forget your spiritual dimension of your personality, of your life, then God gets you completely isolated from your friends. So that you will, you know, sometimes this is what really happens. Think of the life of Saint Francis of Assisi. Think of the life of many, you find many great spiritual personalities, many saints and sages. In all traditions, they woke up when they lost everything. And suddenly they looked around and they found their spiritual goal. Without getting some blows, many people cannot wake up. Of course, there have been many great spiritual personalities who did not require blows all the time. But there are many people who need some tragedies and setbacks which make them open their eyes and look for something beyond the present, beyond the empirical, beyond this world, beyond today. Beyond the world of senses, And then suddenly they get a quantum leap in their spiritual evolution. That's how many saints and sages are born and made. Not, of course, it doesn't mean that you need a crisis to become spiritual. Not at all. You should not come to a wrong conclusion. The idea is this. This verse gives you an intelligent approach to your problems in life. Problems are not problems if you consider them as a wake-up call, as a prompt to look inward, to find out, to discover your own spiritual personality. A problem is a problem only when we do not understand the spiritual implication of a problem. If a problem is no more a problem, rather a problem becomes a pathway, a royal highway leading to spiritual progress, spiritual realization. If we can look upon problems as a wake-up call. So here, in this verse it is said, a person who loses his wealth, a person who gets completely isolated, people who you dependent upon, turn away from you, turn against you when you lose your wealth, when you lose your influence. At that time you think, well, I was depending upon them, I was looking towards them as my permanent friends and well-wishers, no understand where they are. And suddenly you look for a higher meaning, a deeper implication, deeper meaning, a spiritual meaning to your life. Suddenly you realize there is something higher than this body-mind dimension of our personality. That's how many great men and women discover a spiritual meaning in their life, a spiritual dimension to their own personality. So, to develop a correct and proper sense of self-surrender, first of all, we must have a harmonious blending of self-effort or free will and God's grace. Holy Mother Sri Sharada Devi gives two types of advices to her disciples. One, she said, see, look at me, even in this advanced age, I meditate, I pray. So you should also work hard, do japa, pray, meditation, whatever religious tradition you may belong to. And then in another context, she says, just because you meditate, do you think God should appear before you? Some people complain, I meditated for so long, but nothing happened to me. It means I paid so much of money, I didn't get anything. So mother says, God is not a fish or vegetable that you buy from the market. You bargain for it. If we can make self-effort based on confidence, strength and determination, and still be free from the traditional mind, psychology, mindset, we become spiritual. In fact, that's why one of the first and one of the most important characteristics of an ideal devotee mentioned in the Gita is Santushta Satatam Yogi Yatatma Dhranischeha. One is, when you take a spiritual life, the first implication is suddenly you feel a kind of inner fulfillment. Any unselfish deed, thought, or even a desire to do anything unselfish, will have a relaxing, soothing effect in the mind. You can find it. Even if you help a blind man to cross the street without anybody looking on you, and if you go home, you feel a soothing effect on the mind. A kind of inner fulfillment, inner contentment, santushtaka. This first condition of a spiritual seeker. If we can achieve this, then life becomes very pleasant. Chitta prasadam it is called. Then yatatma, we try to control and restrict our senses, give a spiritual direction to whatever we do, with the eyes, with the ears, with the sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of taste, all the five senses of perception. We cannot withdraw the eyes, our eyes, from an object. Suppose you take a decision, I won't see that particular object tomorrow onwards. Mentally you will be seeing only that object. Suppose you take a decision, I won't hear that sound. Mentally you will be hearing that. So what we need to do, all the five senses of perception should be given a spiritual orientation. And this is possible only with a strong will. So once we can combine these qualities, we can find higher spiritual meaning in our own life. And with all the duties and responsibilities and conflicts and busy engagements, we can have an inner soothing effect on the mind, a sense of inner fulfillment. And this, if we start enjoying in our life, that's the beginning of spiritual life. So now we will have interaction. If you want to ask questions, you are free to ask questions. Maybe frequently that is much more helpful than perhaps a lecture. So if there are questions that you would like me to answer, if there are points that you want me to clarify further, you are most welcome to do that. Any questions?
Maharaj, can you please elaborate the six Ramanujas thing for Sharanagati?
Prapatti. Okay.
And please raise your hand or bring the mic. The questions get recorded too, so the answers.
Okay, now this is the technique of self-surrender according to Vaishnava tradition, mostly found in the Ramanuja system of Visishtadvaita. It's called qualified monism. It's called Prapatti Saranagati, meaning is self-surrendered God's will. First is Anukulyasya Sankalpaha. Our thought currents, which are again related to what we do, our actions, should be conducive to spiritual life. You know, our mind has its own food. If we eat bad food, poisonous food, we fall sick and we die. A false thought, a negative thought current, is poison to the mind. So these two go together. We should always stick to spiritually healthy, helpful thought currents. And we must try to avoid its opposite, pratikulyasya varjanam. Means completely avoiding wrong, negative thought currents. I shall give an example. In spiritual life, one great help is the company of fellow spiritual seekers, fellow pilgrims. If you discuss spiritual matters with our friends, fellow spiritual seekers, we get spiritually enriched. It's very helpful. But then, at the beginning of spiritual life, we must strictly avoid the company of those who may take you away from your spiritual path. When I discussed this point in some other place, you know, they asked the question, Brahman is everywhere, Atman is everywhere, so we have to accept all people are the same. Now, I shall give the story of Buddha. Buddha was walking one day, and there was an evil man waiting in the road. Who infested that place, and he had a wonderful hobby. His hobby was cutting the fingers of travelers, poor travelers, and making garland of it and wearing it. That's, so he needed regular supply of fingers. You know. He thought Buddha was going that way. So people want Buddha. This evil robber is staying somewhere nearby on the road. He may attack you, he may kill you, he may cut off your fingers, because he is a very evil person, a monstrous person. Buddha said, well, I am not afraid. So Buddha was walking, and this evil man came with his chopper in his hands to cut off his fingers. Buddha walked on Angulimala. Angulimala means, Anguli means fingers, mala means garland. So he got a wonderful name, a person who decorated himself with garlands made of people's fingers, you know. That was his name. So this man tried to chase Buddha. Buddha walked fast, but so this monster, the evil man, the robber, could not catch up with Buddha. And finally, after some time, this fellow got tired, and Buddha looked back. Immediately, this man was completely transformed, and later on, he became a great Buddha, Buddhist mendicant. He became a disciple of Buddha. He became a Buddhist monk. This Angulimala. Suppose you try to do that. A Buddha can do that. So, spiritually advanced person can look upon all as embodiments of God. God is immanent in every living being. Ishvara sarvabhudanam hrudayase arjuna tishtati. Gita itself says God is immanent. God is an indweller in all beings. God is immanent, omnipresent, and transcendental reality. But we have not reached that stage. Before reaching that stage, we cannot behave like that. So at that stage, we must have a discerning mind. Bhagavad Purana says, Ishvare tadadhineshu balisheshu dishatsucha prema maitri kripa upeksha yak karodi samadhyamaka. A devotee who is trying to advance in his spiritual life, he is a good devotee, but he has not fully established in the highest spiritual experience. Such a devotee, what he should do? He should be devoted to God. And he should seek the company of great spiritual seekers, fellow spiritual seekers. He should have sympathy for those who want to know about spirituality, about God, but who may not know. He should have sympathy. Upeksha means he should keep a long distance, far away from those who are full of negative ideas, who decry, who question everything. You know, there are many skeptics. It's a kind of intellectual arrogance based on negativism. Real intellectual inquiry is the opposite of skepticism. It's like a straight line. It takes you beyond doubt. Swami Vivekananda was an agnostic when he came to Sri Ramakrishna. He asked questions, and Sri Ramakrishna liked it, because it was based on sincere desire to know more. So that sincere inquiry took Swami Vivekananda beyond skepticism, and he became the world teacher. But sometimes people with negative ideas will doubt everything, question everything. And they will try to take you away from your spiritual path. And without you being aware of it, their words, even their presence, will have a negative, a destabilizing influence on your mind. First they will tell you, oh, there is nothing in spiritual life, oh, there is nothing. First you may not take him seriously. But if you are working with that person, and every day if you listen to him, then slowly you find, without you being aware of it, these negative thought currents will start influencing our mindset at the beginning of spiritual life, not when we are fully established in spiritual life. So pratigulyasya varjana means avoiding negative thought currents. That is second factor. They go together, holding fast to positive spiritual thought currents and completely avoiding being totally indifferent towards negative, skeptical thought currents, ideas. And that is very important in the beginning of spiritual life. Then Rakshasvidhi Vishwasa means God will protect me, the strong faith. A strong faith can take you a long way, in fact. Faith is not the opposite of free will. See, if somebody tells there is no God because I don't see him, not to believe in a God because you don't see him is as irrational as to believe in a God whom you don't see. So sometimes people will feel faith is the opposite of free will. No. A creative, constructive faith is at the root of all great innovations, great scientific discoveries. Unless you put a positive faith in something, you cannot go far beyond. So in devotional philosophy, a strong faith that God will protect you is a great help, because it saves you from the influence of negative thought currents. And it enables you to focus your energy and time to spiritual ideas. And it saves you from distraction and dissipation of your concentration and energy, mental energy. And then Gotrutta Varanam Tatha, accepting God as one's protector, guide. Atma Nikshepa Karpanne Shadvidha Sharana. These are six paths, six ways of surrender. One completes resignation to God's will. And then, sometimes, you know, there's a great challenge that we have to face. It's called call of the flesh. It means we sense our attraction to a sensory objects, which is a great obstacle. So a kind of aversion towards the sensory pleasures. Incidentally, you find all these six factors you find in the writings of great Christian mystics of the Russian tradition, Philokalia, Pilgrim's Progress. You find mostly, and also in the writings of Saint Teresa of Avila, and mostly in the writings of Russian mystics. This is very commonly found, all these great faculties, great characteristics, complete surrender, positive thought currents. Only difference is, in Christian mystical tradition, the temptations are always given a kind of anthropomorphism, means it is the temptation of the devil or the evil. In Hindu Vedantic devotional tradition, it is considered to be, an influence of the mind playing tricks with ourselves, because the mind doesn't know its true nature. We do not know our true nature. But a complete self-resignation, self-surrender saves a lot of trouble in spiritual life. Self-surrender is not like formal confession. It is a kind of license renewal. I mean, you do whatever you want and the seventh day you confess. No. In the Augustine's confessions, he discussed confession really is only once, true confession. You confess and that's the end of it. You find Augustine's classics in the City of God and the Confessions you find. So, in Ramanuja system, in the Visishtadvaita system, this wonderful idea of prapatti. Another interesting aspect of this prapatti ideal is, it takes you through different stages of your spiritual life. At the beginning, we may pray to God for material needs. People may pray for wealth. People who are poor, they want money. They don't have a home. Pray, nothing wrong in it. That's what this system says. You are sick. pray to God to cure you, to help you to get cured of this disease. Artho jignyasu arthaarthi jnani cha bharata shavallo. Krishna Gita says, there are those who pray to God because they have some serious wants, sickness, or arthaarthi, they want wealth. These are two stages, preliminary stages of devotional life. You have a need, you have a desire, you pray to God. But they do not belong to the highest devotional type. The point is, Ramanuja says in his Bhashya, even if you pray to God for finding a solution to a material problem, there is a way for you to evolve. Suppose you pray for wealth and you get wealth, and then out of a sense of gratitude to God for listening to your prayer, out of a sense of gratitude, you start praying to the same God without any desire, the next stage. It's a slow evolution from a stage of praying to God for material wants to the next stage of praying to God without any desire. So what happens? A sincere devotee can start his or her spiritual life at any point. Nothing is lost and you are never late. Everyone can and should start from where he or she stands. One should never try to be the highest devotee at the beginning itself. So there are some people, why you should be the highest devotee like Prahlada or nothing? No. We have to start from where we stand. The spiritual life is not a matter of our choice, but it's a matter of our evolution. Where we stand, from there we have to evolve the next stage of spiritual evolution. That means we can combine our everyday life, both spirituality and also the realities of everyday life. Whether you are an official or a housewife or a student or a teacher or anybody for that matter. That is the comprehensiveness of this approach in the Gita.
Swami, you mentioned about total surrender. The basic meaning is the slavery. Simple meaning is basically you dedicate completely to the other thought or the other person or supernatural being. To reach that stage is a total.
Please remember, I am listening to you, but I am not agreeing with your understanding of surrender. Please,
yes, sir,
I shall answer. Please continue.
Right. This is at my level. Okay. Total surrender is like a slavery. You know, basically, you are surrendering everything. And on the other hand, I also see to reach that stage from spiritual standpoint, it is a total enlightenment. You fully understand, either you don't understand or you fully understand and accept it.
Yeah.
So, at what stage a person says, I'm ready for that?
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, real surrender comes only after you have made a lot of effort. And then you have realized in your own experience that there is something, some unknown factor which is still not within my control. Again, this may not be the same for all spiritual seekers. There are different types of spiritual seekers, you know. There are people, see, look at Buddha, for example. He belonged to a different spiritual tradition. He didn't belong to the devotional philosophy of surrender. I was dealing with one of the different approaches. Buddha was a karma yogi. Now, to be a karma yogi, you can be confident, you can have faith in yourself, And with this strong faith in yourself, if you can work without any selfish motive, then you can be spiritual. This is one approach. I was here talking about self-surrender, which is the highest state in a particular school of devotional philosophy, mostly in the Ramanuja system, Chaitanya system, the Vaishnava system of devotional philosophy. But there you find all those who really achieved this level of surrender, they themselves felt highly enriched. They themselves felt they became nothing, but they became so great. In their subjective experience, they became illumined. When we analyze the whole philosophy from our perspective, we may feel, oh, surrender means giving up your freedom, giving up your willpower, you are surrendering your will to a stronger will. This is what we normally understand. But in spiritual life, what happens? The experience is totally different. The writings of the great spiritual devotees who experienced this surrender, they felt so, they built themselves sublimated to a higher level. One example is Tulsidas, Ramchandramanas, Tulsidas. He was a profligate. His own wife told him, the kind of devotion that you show to me, you show to God, you'll become great. Suddenly that opened his eyes. He did not go down in his life. He got a stronger will. His life was enriched. Look at Valmiki, for example, was a robber. So all these great spiritual personalities, they felt, at the subjective level, they felt an inner enrichment. But when we look at it from our perspective, it is a surrender. It is not the not surrender, not the meaning in which the word is taken in the secular, non-spiritual literature or tradition. It is a higher meaning at a subjective level. They feel great peace, not because they have completely given up everything. Valmiki, when he became completely surrendered, he wrote the greatest classic of ancient Sanskrit tradition. Tulsidas, when he surrendered completely, he became so great. So surrender doesn't make you an imbecile, a zero. Rather, it makes you so great, vast and expansive. So this is an important thing to remember. Again, in the psychology of surrender, throughout the autobiographical writings of great mystics and also Hindu classical devotees, you find they did not feel they lost anything. They felt they gained everything. That is subjective experience. Now, this real surrender comes after you have exerted yourself to the utmost. An imbecile, a weak person, cannot practice this surrender. Most, you take any of the great devotees who became great through surrender, they were embodiments of self-effort, willpower, determination. They were great in their own areas. But when they surrendered, what happens? All those faculties got a spiritual orientation. Tulsidasji became a world poet. Valmiki became the greatest poet of ancient Sanskrit tradition. Saint Francis of Assisi became a great saint. Saint Paul became a great saint. Saint Augustine, His parents were very worried about him. Suddenly this man felt that he read something, heard something, he became great. So what really happened in their mind? Did they go down or did they become great? They expanded. They got themselves enriched. But when we look at from our perspective, if you surrender means like an army surrendering its weapons in the battlefield, nothing like that. It is a self-enrichment from a subjective spiritual point of view. Come, please.
Sir, you mentioned about Tulsidas and Valmiki and all these well-known people. Could you, in your own experience, have you seen any person in colleagues or persons you dealt with who is completely self-surrendered, like you are describing?
Yeah, I've seen. I've seen both devotees and also monks. I've seen that. It is still happening. It's still happening. I have seen the place where I'm coming from, great professionals, great IT professionals, presidents of banks taking off and serving in our San Francisco temple, cooking, serving, everything, sweeping the street on Sundays during just before the Sunday lectures. Now, if you look at them, you find, I ask them privately, and you find when they do this kind of work, they feel a kind, oh, I have done something fine. I mean, when you do something unselfish, with a total dedication, you feel a kind of inner fulfillment. This you find not only in devotees, but even in businessmen. Businessmen who make a lot of money, they may not be devotees, but when they make some donation or something, when they support the fighting Ebola or AIDS in the African countries, why they start foundations to help these people in the third world countries? By doing that, they feel a kind of inner peace. They are not devotees necessarily, by doing any unselfish deed, these people get a kind of inner peace, a kind of soothing effect. That's what different. It is actually, this is what people are looking for in this modern age. It may not have anything to do with spirituality, but if by doing something unselfish, without any motive, without any expectation for any return, if by doing that you get, oh, I have done something. You may not tell anybody. You feel within yourself. That is spirituality. Spirituality goes beyond faith in God or rituals. Spirituality has got a higher dimension than conventional, traditional definitions of religion. That's what it is. Yes.
So, today we finish and